welcome to the Breaching Extinction podcast. Mm. I'm here with Jordan Lerma, who graduated from the College of St. Mary's of California with a degree in economics and finance.
Yep.
Awesome. Who is now a whale biologist. Or is that what you
call yourself? I honestly don't know what my title is. But yeah, no, I'm working to be a biologist. I don't think I'd call myself a biologist yet.
No. But you work with Cascadia Research, correct?
Yes.
Awesome. Yep. So can you tell us a little bit about your position, what you do?
Yeah. So I started working field projects with Cascadia Research Collective 3 years ago. And really, we do everything from taking photos to labeling sample vials to processing data at the end of the day. You know, wherever something's needed, we are either expected to learn or are expected to know how to do it. So my position's been, you know, jack of all trades. I was initially approached to do this kind of stuff by flying drones. So I like to call myself the drone pilot for Cascadia, but, you know, anything on project that I need to do is also a priority. So I do a lot of different types of things for Cascadia. I don't, nice. Can't really nail it down just one.
For sure. And for those who don't know, Cascadia is just like essentially a marine mammal research center.
Actually, I mean, Cascadia Research started as a club at Evergreen College.
Oh, I didn't
and
know that.
By, yeah, John Kamakitis. And I believe their first few projects were on bats. So they've done, you know, we have papers out on seabirds.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the project I've worked on is mostly cetacean stuff.
Nice. That's awesome. So you have kind of navigated your way into this field in a unique way or taken a different approach. Most people go to school for like 900 years and then, you know, they end up being whale biologists.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about your story and how you got into this field?
Yeah, no, definitely. So I studied economics and public finance, and I worked at a bank for a couple years, and I was just getting tired of not seeing the sun. You know, I worked for long hours in a cubicle. It was just very depressing. So I decided that I didn't want to waste my 20s doing that. I wanted to find something else, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I moved from San Francisco to Kauai in the state of Hawaii. And I, you know, burned through my savings trying to figure it out. I mean, I took classes that I was interested in till I wasn't interested anymore. And it just so happened I happened upon someone who was flying drones, and I thought that was pretty cool. I think I'd be good at this. So I ended up buying a drone, and very, very luckily it was whale season in Hawaii, so I was like, no one's really filming humpbacks from this angle. I think I can contribute to, you know, at least explaining some of their behaviors from the air. And I would, you know, every morning go out to some beach where I thought the humpbacks would be and fly out over them and record, and then I would share it online. And then people started engaging with me about the content, and, you know, I contributed my videos to various different outlets until it really started getting, it started getting old and boring, and I wanted to find something else. And I have this sort of ADD with all of these different things. And I went to Whale Tales, which is a humpback whale festival in Maui, and my boss now, Robin Baird, was one of the keynote speakers, and I approached him and said, you know, I've been flying over humpbacks for a couple years now. There's got to be something else. Like, what's the next challenge? What can I do to help your research? And he said, you know, let's you know, at the time, he just got drones added on his permit, and, you know, he was curious about the technology but hesitant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough when new types of things come up, and researchers that have been established are very, very hesitant to just, you know, establish them in their current research practices. So I volunteered for a couple projects, and I came out, and he had me do everything but fly drones.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a test to see if I could handle everything else, you know, data sheets, taking photo ID, you know, collecting samples. You know, if you can handle all the other stuff, then maybe you're useful if you don't end up flying drones. So it wasn't until the fourth or fifth project that I volunteered on that he said, you know, bring the drone out today.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just do a trial run to see what it's like to fly the drone.
For sure, yeah.
You know, he wants to get the safety stuff figured out and the logistics of retrieval and those things. And we came across a pod of, I think the final count was 650 melonhead whales.
Wow.
Off the west side of Lanai. And you know, he turned to me and said, let's put the drone up. And I was like, okay, well, this is it. That's a good, it's a good time to try this. And, you know, the footage that we got back is a, it's a perspective. I mean, for someone who's been spending 20 years on the water with these animals, to see them from a different angle really blew his mind.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want to do this with pseudorca. I want to do this with other species. So a couple projects later, we had the opportunity to fly over pseudorca. And we were able to measure them. And, you know, during that encounter, he was like, do you think we can breath sample them? And it's like, why not? Let's try it. Like, we're already here.
Cool, yeah.
You know, and we put the petri dish on the drone and we're able to breath sample false killer whales for the, I think I'm going to take credit. That's the first time it's ever been done.
That's awesome.
So, I mean, now we have projects getting funded to do more breath sampling work with pilot whales and false killer whales. So, you know, it's taking those risks and trying something that no one else has done, but doing it in a way that's, you know, safe and responsible.
For sure.
And within the bounds of his permit.
Right.
Not to, but to try new things, I think he really appreciated that aspect and what I wanted to do. And I think that's why he ended up hiring me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how were they previously getting breath samples then if you weren't using drones?
So breath samples typically are taken from a very long pole with a petri dish at the end.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, it's tricky because you need cooperative animals.
Right.
And, you know, high profile species like pseudorca, which are endangered in Hawaii, tend not to want a bow ride, or the individuals that come into bow ride aren't the individuals you want to target. So
makes sense.
You know, adolescent males tend to come in and bow ride more often than the large females that we want to get hormone analysis on. So, you know, the drone really helps us pick and choose which animals are our targets, and we'll focus on those. And we don't have, we can stay back and let the drone do its thing. So, you know, it's a slightly different approach, but I think in the long run we'll be able to get more meaningful samples from the animals that need more work.
Yeah, that's definitely awesome. I've been on, like, a couple of boats where, like, we were alongside the animals watching them, and then, like, we also had a drone up, and it's, like, it's a completely different thing. Like, there's so much more information that you can get from that, so it's, like, such a valuable tool.
Yeah.
But it seems as though there's a lot of, like, politics around it at the moment, and, like, weird laws. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, no, I mean, the drone industry in general has evolved so quickly the past 5-10 years. You know, there's NOAA doesn't have an established rule on UAVs. They, you know, the FAA classifies them as aircraft, and NOAA has some rules about how close aircrafts can get, but then they also acknowledge that drones aren't really aircrafts because they're not flying humans. I mean, they're very different things. So it's still in a gray area, and, you know, I've researched this issue a little bit, and NOAA's coming out with a rule at some point to, to, you know, solidify what is allowed and what isn't allowed. Yeah, but I mean, anyone flying a drone over whales should just be aware that they have the potential to change their behaviors. And that's not certainly a bad thing. But I think those types of interactions should be documented and reported so that we can understand what our long-term effects are.
For sure.
For any type of harassment, not just drones, but how, you know, naval sonar, boats and shipping.
Right.
There's tons of things that can affect whales and dolphins. But the more we understand, the more that people are transparent and open to talking about it, the better solutions we can get for policy decisions. So.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's, like, a bit of, like, an issue with people thinking that we need to have absolutely no effect whatsoever. Like, that's not realistic in any facet of life.
Yeah.
Like, not have any impact on anything ever. But just, like, being able to minimize that for sure.
Yeah, well, definitely. Minimize and just understand, like, maybe the harassment we're doing doesn't cause them harm.
Right.
That's one thing, too. Like, how people whale watch in the San Juan Islands is done so responsibly that people keep their distance, they limit their time with the animals, they hand off, you know, sightings to the next boat when they're done.
Right.
I mean, it's they all are working together so that they can show their guests a good time, raise awareness for a species that might be dying off, but at the same time, you know, minimize harassment. So it's always a balance with everything. I mean, humans are always going to have an impact. That's our species.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was, like, the one thing I noticed when I came to visit the San Juans. I've always, like, loved education, and I never really wanted to get into ecotourism because coming from Florida, like, those lines were crossed so many times, and, like, seeing boats drive over dolphins. And I came up here because I wanted to see killer whales, and then I saw, like, that they were actually respectful, and I was like, oh, this is different. And I feel like the San Juan Islands is the poster child for how, like, all other areas should interact with, like, wildlife in general.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's always room to improve and to grow, but, like, you know,
yeah.
they're definitely doing a really good job.
Yeah, no, I mean, my goal for all of this, you know, researchers, scientists, and the public and the whale-watching community, the commercial organizations that are operating these whale trips, we all need to work together, because if we don't, the animals will go extinct.
Exactly.
Like, there needs to be cooperation with everyone on board. Like, it's already too late to be fighting over certain things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that being said, what do you, like, think is the biggest threat to the killer whales, the southern resident
whales?
Oh, gosh.
Right now? Oh, I mean, like I said, most of my research is in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm very new to the southern resident issue, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've seen them on the news.
Yeah.
I think understanding and cooperation is a big threat.
Mm-hmm.
I think research organizations and the public and the whale-watching community need to all sit down and talk about it.
Yeah.
And figure out how they can work together to solve the issue.
Yeah.
You know, I know there's a lot of other things, like the food scarcities, but honestly, I don't know enough about all of the different issues that plague the resident population. So I hope that everyone who's working on the issue can come together in the same room and decide on what the priority needs to be to save the animals. And
it has to be
communication. They have to talk.
Yeah. And I feel the same way, which is, like, why I'm doing this podcast, is to try to start that conversation. And
mm-hmm.
like you, I don't know. I know enough about whales and enough about the southern residents to know what to ask, but I don't have all the answers, and I'm not going to pretend like I do. Like, that's what this is. This is, like, it's an investigation and trying to talk to different people. But there's so many entities that are involved, like research groups and nonprofits and government agencies and then other people combating it. It's just, like, there's so much information. Like, I've never seen so much information on how to save an animal, or just information on an animal in general. Like, for some reason, these particular killer whales, like, people are just attached to them.
Yeah.
Did you, like, are the whales in Hawaii similar, or do you think the southern residents are unique in that sense?
No, I mean, the southern residents, I mean, the killer whale is the most identifiable whale in the world, right? I'm sure there's some survey that backs that up. You know, in Hawaii, we have humpbacks that are,
mm-hmm.
you know, viewed in the same way. When the last 4 years of humpback sightings have decreased, they called an emergency meeting to try and figure out why. And
mm-hmm.
I think the same thing happens with the southern residents, but the lack of coordination or cooperation with everyone kind of plagues that and holds them back.
Yeah.
And it is a tough issue. I mean, there are so many different parties involved.
For sure.
That you can't expect everyone to figure out, you know, what the solution is.
Right.
But is it going to be till the point that it's too late?
Yeah.
That we all, like, oh, we've got to do this.
We got to do this,
Or, you know, is that to the detriment of the species? I don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a researcher, we are going out to answer questions, very specific questions about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that it adds to the conversation.
Right.
And we think it hopefully will. But, I mean, that goes back to the whole thing of what questions should we be asking, which questions are the most important.
Yeah. And there's always, like, a 100 different reasons, like, why you would ask something, or a lot of, like, you know, you ask certain questions because you can ask those questions, because there's certain research you just, like, can't conduct because it's, like, not considered ethical, or it's not, you know, there's not the resources to do it, or the technology.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, the whole social media aspect for all of this, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, social media amplifies opinions.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, it's tough for people in power to say certain things without it getting misconstrued somewhere down the pipeline on social media.
Absolutely.
Causing with a species as popular as the southern residents, it's...
It can get a little out of hand.
Their popularity definitely doesn't help.
Yeah.
I
didn't realize that there was, like, such a community of, like, whale photographers. Like, that's, like, a whole little niche of people. And then I met Andrew Harpster and Adam Ernster at the job that I work at now, and, like, they kind of opened up that door of, like, oh, look at all these people. And, like, there's, like, a bunch of people that follow all of these, like, whale photographers. And it's just interesting because it's, like, you know, they're not biologists or anything, but those are the ones that people look up to. And, like, those are the people that are, like, the stewards for that species. So you have to be really careful what you say.
No, it's a very interesting issue because, you know, a lot of these whale watch companies have professional photographers on board
mm-hmm.
who are able to get incredible photos of these animals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, working on the research side of things under permit, we're restricted to what we can share. So it's tough to compete with ideas, yeah, because they have the viral content,
mm-hmm,
and we are here trying to spread awareness or, you know, share what we find by doing our research,
yeah,
but we don't have the same voice
as they do. So where do we bridge that gap?
Yeah, how do we bridge that gap?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a tough one.
I think maybe trying to start the conversation with those, you know, photographers and things like,
yeah,
that. Because I've heard, you know, from some of the people in that community that there are certain people that they don't necessarily care about the whales. They care about, like, the followers, and they care about all that kind of stuff. You just have to find a way to articulate that to speak for the animals as well.
Yeah. No, I've interacted with a lot of photographers, and I truly believe they love the animals to some extent. They have to, and they wouldn't be there if they didn't. You know, social media definitely changed the whole game by, you know, follower count and, mm-hmm, engagement. So it's interesting to see the egos of these photographers come out, and, you know, I hope that they're thinking long term about what their legacy is. Is it going to be their most liked photo, or is it that the fact that the one photo could, you know, perhaps save a population from extinction?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what their legacy? What do you want their legacy to be?
Exactly.
It's a tough issue for someone to understand, especially when social media does the things that they do.
It does. And it's easy to get that ego boost. And I feel like, you know, scientists are not, we're not exempt from that. And I'm not saying I'm a scientist, mm-hmm, but I think like a scientist.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of egos in the scientific field. And you had made a post, actually, that, you know, initiated the conversation that we're having now, where you had mentioned that you're surrounded by a lot of really smart people and that that's intimidating. And, you know, you've had to work harder than some of these people because you don't have that background. And I can absolutely relate. I mean, I do have the science degree, but like, I've had a lot of other things go on that have made struggles like to get into this field like so many other people. And I was kind of hoping you could speak to that, because I feel like that's very relatable for, you know, people that want to connect to these animals. And that's one of the bridges that I want to kind of create, is that gap between like people being intimidated by science and connecting to the animals. Because at the, yeah, end of the day, it's important to inspire people, not intimidate them.
Yeah, no, it's definitely intimidating being in a room with other PhD folks who've dedicated their lives to studying very specific questions on the animals you're researching. And, you know, the level of conversations that they have, you're almost expected to be at that level.
Yeah.
And it's hard to admit when you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So what you spend your time reading every single paper they've ever published,
mm-hmm,
to at least know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that you have to work twice as hard or three times as hard, I forget what I said, it's because you have to catch up,
yeah,
to their level of understanding so that you can perform in your position so that they aren't held back by you.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that we need to work on in our community, like, of scientists, is, like, knowing that we're all scientists because we don't know. That's why we want,
yeah,
to do science, is because we want to know things. But being patient and trying to, you know, think back, you know, to when you were an undergraduate, or,
yeah,
when you were even just, like, a high school student, or wherever you were at your stage in life. Like, there's nothing wrong with not knowing.
Yeah,
but we all just,
definitely,
have to get there, and I feel like there needs to be a little bit more patience in the community, for sure.
And I think, too, like, just because you're surrounded by really smart people doesn't mean you can't bring anything to the table.
For sure.
I was on a boat and, you know, surrounded by these really smart people. How many of them can hand catch and inspire? None of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have an individual skill that they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about figuring out what those skills are and how you can make them valuable to those people.
Absolutely.
That makes you a very valuable member of a team.
Mm-hmm.
Because having really smart people is one thing, but having a very diverse crew of talent,
yeah,
so, you know, you're a lot more successful as a team,
yeah,
rather than a very small amount of,
for
really,
sure,
smart people.
And that'll definitely, like, you know, set you apart and make your research a little bit more dynamic, is like, if you're, you know, you think about things differently because of the type of training that you've had or the type of training that you haven't had, you know. Because if we're all trained the same way of, like, you know, this is how we take pictures of animals and this is how we study them, like, you know, are we looking at things differently at all? Are we really answering those questions? So,
mm-hmm,
it definitely is helpful to have, like, as many perspectives as possible.
Yep, very, very true. You know, and then this, you know, I get this question kind of often, like, how did you get, you know, you asked me earlier, how do you get your position at Cascadia?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to this exact topic. How do we how do we bring new skills to the research team?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we live in an age where we can learn anything on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Learn how to fix a boat engine.
Yeah.
Learn how to tie knots. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people can't fasten a line mm-hmm. on a boat. You know, learn skills that other people might not be interested in.
Right.
Because that's really how you get your foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can learn the science stuff later.
Yeah, for sure. So what was it like the first time you saw the southern resident killer whales, or a killer whale in general?
Let's see. The first time I saw a killer whale, it entangled itself on a crab pot. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I've never seen an animal entangle itself purposely.
Right.
And then it disentangled itself, and then entangled itself again. So I was like, okay, that's a very interesting mm-hmm. day. I've never seen an animal do that. I was like, well, that's a transient. So I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. The lone male. I forget which tea it was, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I saw the residents was maybe 3 weeks ago. And it was cool. I mean, there's mm-hmm. so much hype about them. You know, I hate to admit that I don't get connected to these animals as much as other people who really admire these.
Right.
I mean, my passion is how do we answer questions, you know, how do we use technology to answer questions that could help save populations.
Yeah.
So, you know, a new species is always cool. A new, mm-hmm. new encounter is always cool. I always look forward to the next one. But yeah, I mean, it's awesome to be able to see them here.
Yeah.
It's crossed
Absolutely.
Off my bucket list.
For sure. Have you worked with any other endangered species?
So false killer whales in Hawaii are mm-hmm. endangered. There's 163 of them
okay.
Left in the insular population. So that's our main species of focus mm-hmm. in Hawaii.
Nice.
It's always a treat when they pop up. I mean, mm-hmm. they're usually uncooperative. So they usually come in Beaufort 3, Beaufort 4.
Yeah.
So it's tough to work with them.
Absolutely.
But rewarding. I mean, we've got satellite tags out on them. We've done biopsy. We've done photogrammetry.
That's
we've done
awesome.
Breath sampling. You know, they're one of the most well-known populations in the world because of what Cascadia has done in Hawaii.
That's awesome.
You know, even leading to how they were listed as under the Endangered Species Act, you know,
mm-hmm.
due to credit to a lot of the satellite tag data that we got from differentiating them from a pelagic population or
mm-hmm.
northwestern Hawaiian Island population. So getting them listed as a distinct population segment and
nice.
Then listed as an endangered species is awesome. And, you know, has gone to protecting a lot of different things in Hawaii as a trickle-down effect from just
For sure.
protecting them. So, you know, it's cool working with endangered species.
Yeah.
You know, the humpback whale was also delisted a few years ago.
That's good. Yeah. Nice.
Which is comforting to see, at least the segment that goes to Hawaii. And the only other endangered species I think that is still listed is the sperm whale.
Okay.
And I don't know if I should mention this on the podcast, but the only time I've ever cried when seeing a cetacean was a sperm whale.
That's okay. Yeah. We've all been there.
Okay,
We've
good.
All been there.
Yeah.
I saw a beluga. That was like the first cetacean that I cried at. I
yeah.
was, when I was in high school, I had this really cool opportunity to go study polar bears in Canada. My zoo sponsored me, the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium. They gave me like a scholarship and I went and I saw wild polar bears and I cried with that too. But that
yeah.
was like the pivotal moment of like, this is what I'm doing. But we were at, I can't remember the name of the park, but we saw like little beluga heads pop up from
oh,
like,
wow.
I don't know, like probably 200 yards away. And I'm like 16 and I'm like standing there, I'm like sobbing. Like I don't even know what this animal is, but there was just like something about it.
Yeah.
But I did that with the orcas as well.
Yeah.
Like I've cried about the orcas several times. We've all been there.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I'm like, that sperm whale sighting, I like had premonition the day before, or the morning of. I was like, we're gonna fucking see sperm whales today.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as soon as they took a breath, man, just felt it.
You were just like, there it is.
I mean, sperm whales in Hawaii are revered. They're Hawaiian culture symbols, so
yeah.
More so than I guess, you know, any cetacean in Hawaii is a representation of one of the gods, Kanaloa.
Mm-hmm.
So. Sperm whales, the royalty used to wear their teeth as jewelry, as a status symbol.
Okay.
So I don't know if it was that or, you know, I just felt instantly connected to that.
And you
that
grew
animal.
Up in Hawaii?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that played into it. So what role have whales played in Hawaiian culture?
Oh, that is a very tough question. That is a no. That's a very loaded question, and that's one of the things I've been looking into recently. You know, like I said, they're a manifestation of one of the gods, Kanaloa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever there's a stranding in Hawaii, there's a Hawaiian cultural practitioner that comes out and does a proper burial or mm-hmm. a proper ceremony to give honor to the, mm-hmm. the animals that stranded. You know, and you know, I'm still doing research on all this. My sister's worked. My sister's a lawyer. She does
nice.
A lot of the. She's worked with a lot of the protection groups for Native Hawaiian rights.
That's awesome.
And what I've learned through her experiences was that when animals strand, is a message from the afterlife, and giving the animals back into the ocean is a way to communicate with your ancestors.
Okay.
So I mean, there's a lot of those types of. Things that happen in Hawaiian culture still that are you know, not really reported on or talked about, but
right.
You know, I hope won't be forgotten with the older generation.
Right.
So trying to remember these things is
absolutely
important.
I think that's really interesting too, because up here, like, we've heard about like the Lummi people having a spiritual connection to the orcas, and it's just interesting that it seems though it's universal that people like historically have had a spiritual connection to whales. And that is something I would love to study. I don't know how you study that.
Yeah. Let me know.
But yeah, no, it's really interesting. And one of the things I've always wondered if, like, you know, their consciousness of their breath is something that contributes to that. Because there's themes in, like, yoga and different religions of, like, breath work and meditation having to do with, like, enlightenment and spiritual growth. And maybe whales are more enlightened. And, but how do you study that? You don't know. And then you go down this track and get discredited because, you know, scientists are like, what are you saying?
Yeah,
like,
no, it's a good balance. I mean, you have to find... I think people need to ask those questions, though, right? Mm-hmm. Like... keeps it interesting.
Absolutely. That's really cool.
I think that, you know, those types of things help lead to more of the protections too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely like some spiritual connections to the whales, which is probably why you cried when you saw a sperm whale.
No.
I cried when I saw a beluga and an orca
I totally feel it.
Yeah.
Totally relate.
Yeah. Are there any experiences that you've had with whales that have been particularly impactful?
Ooh, that's a tough one, too. You know, breath sampling the false killer whale for the first time, definitely. That was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
So that encounter by itself is probably one of the best encounters I've had. We had 19 miles off of... 19 miles north of Kauai High on the Big Island,
mm-hmm.
Right in the middle of the Maui Channel. We encountered the false killer whales, and they had found a mahi-mahi under a floating ball that had come loose off one of the boats,
mm-hmm.
and they were just going at it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they try to hit it with their belly.
Wow.
They look really weird when they try
mm-hmm.
to breach and predate on mahi. So they're just hitting this poor mahi into the air over and over and over before they finally ate it. So just that in itself, I mean, we got the drone over it and got to film that, which was amazing. And then, you know, we kept following the animals and they ate the mahi and, you know, went to this consistent surfacing state and we were like, let's breath sample.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one encounter really changed my perspective. Well, changed my life. I mean, I wouldn't be here if I didn't keep pushing
for
the boundaries of what drones can do in research. So,
absolutely.
You know, being rewarded with a sample, after persevering with an endangered species, That helps a lot with motivating you to keep going to breast sample the next one
and
work harder to do things more consistently, figure out protocols to do things better.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that one really, I can remember every moment of that encounter. And it's good motivation to keep going.
How do you think that doing drone research is going to change the way that we understand the animals? Because clearly, like, there's only so much that you can understand from looking at something from the side, from, like, a surface point of view. When
I think that's a good question. And, you know, it's not so much of... So, you know, when we do photogrammetry of any animals, we make it a point to simultaneously take a photo from the boat of the individual we're measuring so that we can add that... level of, or that data set to mm-hmm. our existing catalog.
Mm-hmm.
So it supplements a lot of what we already know about an animal. Mm-hmm. And then when we track measurements over time, we can see if the population is growing or shrinking, you know, mm-hmm. if animal's pregnant or not, animal's sick or not.
Right.
And then add another layer with breath sampling. So it's mm-hmm. just another data set that we're mm-hmm. able to contribute to supplement what we already know about a species.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think drones have the ability to change a lot about how researchers operate.
For sure.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see drones to biopsy and tag in the future.
Yeah.
I mean, SnotBot's already trying to do photo ID from autonomously with the drones.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think things will evolve very, very quickly as they have in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, as technology gets better, as more and more people start to use it, you'll see a lot of new techniques come to light and how we are able to use these technologies to answer questions.
For sure. So how do you see technology progressing maybe in the next 5 years, like to continue to get more data about these animals?
Well, I, you know, cameras will get better. Batteries will get more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Longer flight times,
yeah.
Better photos, heavier payloads.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see, you know, personally, more ways to measure animals.
Mm-hmm. Physically measure like animals. That's a question that I get a lot on my boat is like, how long is that whale? How do we know? And I'm like, I don't know how they measure a whale. Cause I've had experience trying to measure a dolphin, or at least trying to watch other people at Moat Marine Lab measure a dolphin. And that's a whole task within itself.
Yeah.
It's not easy to capture like a bottlenose dolphin, let alone an orca whale or a sperm whale.
Yeah, no, I you know, with the how these AI algorithms are evolving, I wouldn't be surprised to see a learning algorithm, you know, be able to accurately predict the measurements of whales just based on photos.
That'd be great.
You know, I know there's a couple folks from Duke that are already doing that with humpbacks.
Nice.
You know, AI measurements instead of having to have people process photos in the lab. So, you know, I'm optimistic that, you know, this whole AI revolution will solve a lot of issues with the way, you know, our bottlenecks with how we process data nowadays.
And what is AI?
Well, artificial intelligence is such a broad term. But really, like, convolutional neural networks is really what it comes down to. And it's feeding enough data into a learning set that the computer can infer, based on similarities between photos, how big an animal is.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome.
It's already happening, so I wouldn't be surprised that more...
It's just going to, like, continue to take
off. It'll just get better. I mean, as we get more images of these animals with the drones, learning libraries will get better.
Nice.
Yep, so it's just a matter of time before...
Before we get more and more information.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that with the progression of technology, we're going to be able to get a lot more information on these animals, because it's always a question of ethics, and, you know, we don't want to disturb their behavior too much, but I think that technology is a really good way to get more information without, like, and do it a little bit less invasively.
Yeah.
Is there any technology that you've seen recently that has sparked an interest or that you think is, like, particularly interesting to share?
Yeah, one of the coolest technologies that I, like, literally a couple hours ago I was hanging out with, there's a dog named Iba who sniffs for whale scat.
What?
And she's put the research team on resident poop.
Amazing.
And, you know, it's this rescue dog who's owned by a researcher on island, Deborah Giles.
Oh my gosh, I'm interviewing her
in
a couple days. Yeah,
no, Deborah Giles, I mean, be sure to interview Eva too. I just set her up an Instagram account, and she's just the sweetest dog. But, you know, just her story of... Literally, she was a rescue dog.
Aww.
Who was like, do you think Iba would be good at doing this for orca research? And they just tried it, and she found a sample. Like, it's awesome.
Oh, my god!
So when we go talk about technology, like, Iba is my inspiration right now. I'm just
what
very...
What kind of dog is she?
She's a Jack Russell Terrier mix.
Oh, cute.
Yeah.
So cute.
Yeah.
So she goes out on the boats and just, like, smells for poop?
Yeah. I mean, I won't ruin the interview with Giles. I mean... You got to see her with her life vest on.
Oh my
She's
gosh.
A star. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Be sure to follow her on Instagram. Her handle is Iba, the orca dog.
Ebith the orca dog. Okay, I'll make sure I'm in the process of putting together a website. Hopefully by the time that this is like
On
the internet, there will be a website and I'll put a link to it on there.
Good. I'm sure she'll get her profile. I did a whole Instagram tutorial with her this morning. So
amazing.
Yep, she's going to be a star. I feel it.
How could she not be?
Exactly, like, right?
How can you not? A dog that studies whale poop.
Yep.
It's everything everyone wants.
Yeah, we had to list like her category on her Facebook page, and we're like, she's a scientist.
Oh, she absolutely is a scientist, for sure.
Yeah.
That's awesome. It's very interesting to see, like, you know, the connections that people form with animals and animals with people. And I'm reading a book right now. It's called Endangered Orca by Monica Shields. And she was talking about Luna, one of the resident killer whales. Are you familiar with the story of Luna?
Mm-mm.
But basically, this whale was separated from its pod, and they're not entirely sure why. But it, like, started to make noises make acoustics similar to, like, seals and sea lions to try to connect with them, and then eventually developed a relationship with humans. It's a very famous whale. But it's interesting to see those, like, different connections that are made, and I wonder if the dog is curious, like, about these things, too. You never know what's going on in there. You can't ask, but...
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm very curious. No, it's just amazing. You know, when we think about technology replacing all of these different things, you look at Eba, and it's just like, there's no piece of technology that can do what Eba can do.
Literally, no.
There's none. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. She was one of a kind. I hope I get to meet her.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be cute if she can meet my dog. I wonder if I can get my dog to small orca poop.
Worth a try.
Yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
It's just amazing.
Cute. Yeah. I don't think I have any more questions. Is there anything else you want to add or anything you think is important?
Let me think about that. I think I covered pretty much all of my life story.
Yeah.
One of the best pieces of advice I've gotten from my boss, Robin Baird, was to become a birder.
Okay.
And I've always been interested in birds.
Sure.
But never to the point where you can look at a bird and try to identify what
the
species
individual?
It is.
Oh, the species.
Is it a male, female, breeding, breeding, non-breeding, a juvenile, first year, second year, like...
Mm-hmm.
Look out in San Juan Islands and try to identify seagulls.
Yeah.
That's a good one, a good exercise in itself.
Yeah.
And his point is that birders have very good observational skills that translate over to pretty much any other area of research.
Okay.
In Hawaii, we have to be, you know, focused on so many different things that having good observational skills is such a good thing to be good at.
For sure.
Any advice to anyone out there?
Become a birder.
Become a birder. Join one of the bird watching groups and just, you know, count how many native species are in your backyard. Like, that's pretty fun.
And if you live in the middle of nowhere, just get a guide. Go buy a local guide and go just look for birds.
No matter where you live in the world, there will be native birds.
Yeah, that's true.
That's one of the fun things about birds. They are everywhere.
Yeah. They are everywhere.
I often get told by people on the boat that if you don't see birds, you aren't looking hard enough.
Yeah.
And it's very true. Like, if you can't find a bird, you're not going to find a whale.
Yeah, that's true.
So, good skill.
Can't escape them.
Nope.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all I have.
Thanks for letting me talk.
Yeah, no, thanks for talking. Thanks for sharing.
Anytime.
Yeah.
I hope we get to follow this up, like, in a couple years.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Because that'd be cool,
that
like, before
be
and
cool.
after.
Yeah,
like,
before.
I'm a biologist now.
Yeah. That would be awesome.